down upon the Wabash, such land was never known. If Adam had passed over it, the soil he'd surely own. He'd think it was the garden he'd played in when a boy, and straight pronounce it Eden in the state of Illinois. Then move your family westward, good health you will enjoy, and rise to wealth and honor in the state of Illinois.
Welcome back to Nocturnal Journal on WGN 720. I feel like Rich Warren or something. The next hour is going to be a tribute to the 60th anniversary of the Old Town School of Folk Music. And in studio, we have musician, longtime teacher since 1980. It's in my notes, but I'll ask you directly.
Yes, yeah, it's way back then.
Yeah. Mark Dvorak.
Thank you.
And we have Colby Maddox, a resource center manager and musician.
Yep.
Got some music questions for you. And we have Mareva Lindo.
Hello.
Hi there. How are you? And you're the podcast producer, so I got questions on that. And you've been doing that for 2.5 years?
Yes.
In conjunction with StoryCorps? Is that right?
StoryCorps reached out to us about a year ago, and Mark actually was part of the very first interview that we did as part of that, or conversation, with his first guitar teacher at the school, Mike Dunbar. We've been working on that collaboration for the past year and are now doing a culminating work, a six-part documentary series.
Before I get off that, what was that song we played? I picked it, but tell us, that was Pete Seeger's version.
It was Pete Seeger's version of a song called Illinois. It's spelled E-L-A-N-O-Y, and it was kind of an old-fashioned real estate advertisement. They wanted people to come move to Illinois back in the years of statehood.
They need to use that again.
Yeah, that's right. That's right. And Wynn, actually, that was one of his Wynn Strachey, that was one of his signature pieces, and he learned it from the poet Carl Sandburg.
Right.
So it's a booster song. I just learned that term tonight.
I always like to do the show like 101. Like, I just assume, like, somebody's listening, you know, on the road, like in our first segment, driving a truck, never listened to the station before, don't know anything. So tell us about the Old Town School. December 1st was the 60th anniversary. I was going to make the question specific for our listeners, and based on your history and what you know. Mark, you weren't there
I wasn't
in 1957.
There.
But what was, in your research, what was the school then and what is it now?
Well, my understanding was the Wynn Strachey, of course, was a beloved broadcaster through the 1950s. And during the years on the House and Un-American activities, he wound up losing his broadcast job. He said, but in the back of my mind, I always had this idea for a music school, different than a conservatory. A place where just people like you and I could come and learn how to sing and play together. And he met a very talented young musician at the old Gate of Horn. And his name is Frank Hamilton. And Frank was Wynn's accompanist for a string of dates. And they got to know one another. And it was time for Frank to go out to New York City. And Wynn said, well, how much money would you need to stay here? I've had this idea for lessons. So they set up some informal lessons in the home of Nate and Don Greening in Oak Park, Illinois. And Wynn said, when I saw Frank be able to teach different skill levels at the same time and then bring everybody together for a big jam session, I knew I had my teacher. I knew we would have our school. So about a year later, the Old Town School opened at 333 West North Avenue, and it's kind of like Woodstock in a way. You meet people who were there. They said, I was there that night. And if all of them were telling the truth, there would have been about 1,000 people. And I asked Lance Greening, the son of Don, and who was there on opening night. He said, I think about 75 people, but the school was born. And
this is radio, although some people can look in, but some of these opening night pictures, people are kind of dressed up.
Yeah.
I mean, was it because opening night, or is that what people wore all the time in 1957?
I don't know. I think people dressed up, you know, a little more.
You see that at baseball games, too.
Yeah, that's right.
Yeah. Yeah. But it was a big deal.
It was a big deal. By the time I got to this school in the 19, according to Mike Dunbar, I met in his class in autumn of 1979. And when I walked in the place, I thought, oh man. And it was, the building was, it was comfortable, I think is a nice word, and wooden, and and it was run by hippies, and I loved it, you know, so it's very different, very, very casual kind of a place.
I think there's maybe an interesting answer to that. Bob Reisman, who wrote biography of Big Bill Brunsie, was just at a really nice sort of like story and song sharing event that Mark also was at on this past December 1st, the 60th anniversary. And he was talking about how a big part of the school's success was a week beforehand, Big Bill Brunsie, there was a benefit in his honor because he had cancer. And there was something had gone wrong and people were trying to raise money for his medical bills. Apparently, like, I believe it was Studs Terkel in particular and WFMT as well were an enormous part of making that a successful event, as well as like telling the people who came to that and telling people after that event about the school's opening. So it was probably a ton of WFMT listeners who might have been like polished people, as well as like folkies who were more inclined to walk into a place called the Old Town School of Folk Music. Like Ella Jenkins was there, Ginny Clemens, they were the two first people in line, famously. There's a photo of them. Yeah. It was a real mix of people, but I think WFMT was like a huge part of that, as well as Big Bill Brunsie's familiarity in the Chicago scene, contributed by Studs too.
How important, I really want to kind of just, I don't know, when I was researching this, I'd written about it a few anniversaries for the Sun-Times, but I really want to shine some light on Wynn and stuff. And how important was politics and using music as a labor organizing tool in the origin of the school culture?
Yeah, very, very important, but also very deep important. Not something that was necessarily worn on the sleeve all the time. This is the kind of commitment that that came from being part of a labor theater group in the 30s, 1938.
The Chicago Repertory Group.
Chicago Repertoire Group.
Yeah.
Studs Terkel and Wynn Strachey met in 1938 as part of this group. And this was, that bled seamlessly into being part of this group called Come For to Sing, which was Big Bill Brunsie, Studs Terkel, Wynn Strachey, and Larry Lane singing topical songs. Each would sing a song from their own tradition, and that toured. So these things had artistic merit, but they were also had social consciousness to them. So they were ways to make to humanize the world and make a world which had huge inequities between racial inequities and labor inequities. Huge things like that, basically make them real, and so that people would think about them, and the concept was you would never put that in people's face, like with a huge blaring sign, but you would continually have a body of work, which Studs and Wynn both had, that reflected your beliefs and that was good, that could be consumed by the public.
And then you would start a school and open it up across the hall from the IWW office.
Yes, exactly. But these were things that Wynn eventually did pay for, because there were whisperings behind his back in the trade magazines that you shouldn't let your kids watch Animal Playtime, because this is very dangerous. This guy Uncle Wynn is very dangerous. And then once stuff like that starts, it's hard to stop it. And so Studs actually commented on the situation. He said he and Wynn were the Chicago Two.
Yeah.
Whereas how many people in L.A. were blacklisted? Yeah. It was 15 or something. Yeah. But he said it was like that in Chicago. They just start talking about you and writing little whispers, and then you lose your work. So that's I think politically they weren't asking for it.
I mean, yeah, Studs said he always defended the underdog.
Yeah.
That Wynn was... did you ever meet Wynn?
I never met Wynn, no.
But you did. Yeah. At the end of his life. He was 82 or something.
Yes, yeah. I went to visit him. He was living... when he retired, he moved to Mexico. And then later to Fort Collins, Colorado. And towards the end of his life, he moved to a comfortable residence in Evanston, Illinois. And I met him backstage at one of the anniversary concerts at Symphony Center. And there he was on the finale. There was like 40 people on stage. And I looked over in the wings, and there he was leaning on his cane. And I went over and introduced myself. And he said, well, come on over and see me sometime. And so I did. And we struck up a friendship. And I thought it was a neat thing just to meet, you know, this guy who I was learning about and a real legend in Chicago music. But over the years, I've looked back on our conversations and I only now realize how lucky I was to have touched him and been able to carry him with me wherever I go.
We're going to take a break. I got some questions for you. But we're going to come back with a song. I'm really excited to hear this. Because I missed it on WGN television. You did a little bit of this on WGN
sure
television.
Did, yeah.
Mark DeVart. So we'll be back with our tribute to the Old Town School of Folk Music 60 years after this on WGN.
As I walked down the streets of old Chicago, oh, the moon was rising high and lights aglow. Memories flickered by just like phantoms in the sky of other feet who walked these streets so long ago. As I walked down the streets of old Chicago, great names from the past I do recall. Big Bill and Fleming Brown, when Strachey's not around, I'm so proud to be a small part of it all. Give a little, take a little, let your poor heart bleed, babe, a little, but baby, that's the glory of love. Sigh a little, cry a little, let the clouds go by, babe, a little, but baby, that's the glory of love. Long as there's just the two of us, we have the world and all of its charms. Long as there's just the two of us, we'll hold each other's arms. Baby, now win a little, lose a little, sometimes have those blues, babe, a little, but baby, that's the glory of love.
WGN. Thank you, Mark Dvorak, for when you get to the mic. Tell us what that little mashup was about. I know Gloria Love. And
well, that first piece was a song called The Streets of Old Chicago. It was written by a man named Howard Armstrong, the great old-time fiddle player, and many knew him as Louie Bluey. And I think he borrowed a tune, an old-time tune called Old Fashioned Love, and he kind of wrote a love song to his home city. And so I was with a bunch of folks hanging out at the school one day, and we decided to change the words around. We were sitting in the lobby, and there was a picture of Big Bill, and there's a picture of Win Strachey, and there's Fleming Brown, the great banjo player and educator, and we just decided to make it our song about the Old Town School.
Martin Bogan and Armstrong.
Martin Bogan and Armstrong, that's right.
You know, I grew up in the suburbs. I grew up in Naperville. You know, so my window into some of those songs you just played was Steve Goodman.
Of course.
He would cover those.
Yes,
stuff.
He did.
Talk about some of the people like that who came through the school that people may not know about. You know.
Oh, my
Roger
goodness.
Roger McGuinn, people talk about that.
Yeah. Well, you know, Goodman came through, and there's this picture of a lonesome-looking John Prine after his Guitar 3 lesson when he was, I guess, just out of the Army. Who else has come
well,
through the school,
I'm
Mareva?
I'm covering that exact era in the next episode of the podcast, which is coming out on Thursday. So I was just with these people this afternoon. Steve Goodman, on actually his live from the Earl of Old Town record, he does a Carl Martin tune that he learned from him. And I thought that was really cool. I had no idea that they were connected. But a lot of the people Eddie Holstein talks about, whose brother was Fred Holstein, who a lot of people might recognize as well, he listed off a bunch of people who he was buddies with, but also who would just be playing at the Earl of Old Town or Poor Richards was another place, Somebody Else's Troubles later on. But Bonnie Kolak, I think, was a big superstar of the scene, along with Steve Goodman. There was some people who, I don't know if I've even heard recordings of, but Bill Koitman was a big name at the time. Yeah. A few others, of course, John Prine. There's that story about Steve Goodman telling Kris Kristofferson to go check out his buddy John Prine, like, if you like what I do, you're going to be blown away by my buddy, John.
Yeah.
And
we had Dave on the show not long ago.
I saw the picture on your
site. Dave was quite good.
He's good.
I've never heard him play before.
He played on
He brought John into the school, right?
Yeah. I'm not sure.
Yeah.
He was a teacher at the school in the earlier days. And Eddie was saying that he did know Dave first early on. And he was part of, a string band, I think with Fleming Brown even.
Oh, he was, absolutely. Yeah, he was.
And he's got a string band now, I think.
Yeah, a lot of the early inspiration before a lot of these names we've mentioned came from having the Gate of Horn be a club that was in Chicago, and that was one of the first full-time folk clubs, and it was founded by Bob Dylan's manager, and it brought a lot of people through, and people like Odetta, like Bob Gibson, and this is kind of what we're finding when we're looking at the history. We're finding a lot of that did light the fire for the little Chicago scene that people are talking about and remembering. It did have that fire of a national club behind it, which is totally interesting, because sometimes Chicago gets seen as kind of an outpost, but it really was a very central post in the folk world. As that retreated, our own people kind of moved in.
Interesting.
I find it interesting too that when Wynn and the little group that finally started the school, they thought Chicago was the perfect place for it because it was first of all a multi ethnic city, multicultural city where like 100 some languages are spoken within the borders of the city, but also it was sort of out of the shadow of Broadway theater and Hollywood. It was a working town, and of course we have our own theater district, and there were a lot of movies shot here, but he felt this kind of music could take root better here without record deals flying around all the time.
We kind of moved off that, and you're right. I mean, it was working town, the labor history of this town, and because I want to get into some other things after the news, but we're talking about the underdog and the class division and stuff. Is there any better time? I mean, we're talking about what's going on right now in 2017. Mm-hmm. How does the school respond to that in its mission today?
Well,
some of the stuff that's going on politically.
Earlier in the year, we acquired a new president in the United States, and there was a great deal of fear running through our school. There were people of Hispanic heritage were afraid they would have to leave. They didn't know what to do. There's a very strong gay community in our school. They expressed lots and lots of concern. And our director, Bob Graves, wrote this beautiful letter to everybody. I still have my copy on email, and it goes to every folk, and that means I don't know how many people it gets, but he's speaking to everybody. And he said, you're safe here, you know, and it was very touching, and it made me feel that, you know, we're teaching artists and we're performers, and I think the practice of art can take that conversation to a different place. Wynn told a story. And then the Democratic National Convention happened in 1968. And then the school's autumn session opened 2 weeks later. And he said there was a young man in a flannel shirt with long flowing hair picking bluegrass guitar with a guy he knew as an off-duty Chicago policeman. He said 2 weeks ago they had been hitting each other over the head with sticks and rocks. Tonight they're picking bluegrass. And music gives us a place where we can agree.
This is great stuff. We got to take a break for David Jennings and news. And I don't want to let that go because we've done segments on the show about what happened to protest music. I've been out on the street a little bit, not recently, but with my friends who go, where's the protest music? So I want to talk about that after David Jennings and the news on WGN.
No, I forgot the first word. I remember loving you back when the world was new. I think you loved me too. I remember loving you on the winter street where the frozen sleet comes soaking through the cardboard in my shoes. The promised land might be a place where a man could find free cigarettes and booze. In the alleyways full of ragged strays, the doorway wine we tell our troubles to. I remember all these things, mostly I remember loving you. I remember loving you back when the world was new. I think you loved me too. I remember loving you. I remember loving you and all the things we knew and all we've left to do. I remember loving you.
Welcome back to Nocturnal Journal on WGN, and that's Mark Dvorak with Fred Holstein's I Remember Loving You. Today, I believe, would have been Fred's 75th birthday.
Yeah.
Is that right? December?
Yeah, good old Fred.
Fred, you and I talking on the phone, Mark, when I was doing my important pre-interviews. But I know Eddie really well, and Eddie's at the school and stuff. But I never got to know Fred that well. No. Talk about Fred when you met Fred.
Well, the first time I saw Fred, he was playing a concert at a place called Stages Music Hall, which is way on the north side, with a guy named Utah Phillips. And I'd heard of Utah Phillips. And I knew some of his songs, but I'd never seen him. And it turns out this guy we knew was getting married, and he had a bachelor party. And what he wanted to do for his bachelor party was to go listen to folk music. It gives you an idea of the kind of swinging people I was hanging around with back then. And so we got in this big old hall, and we got some drinks, and we sat in the front row, and there came Fred, and he opened the concert with the beautiful song, I Remember Loving You. And then he got out his banjo, and he started strumming the chords to Woody Guthrie's Roll on Columbia. And we were in the front row, and he raised his hand, and he said, everybody. And I thought, well, where are we, summer camp here? And over the back of my head, you know, there's 200 voices singing in harmony, and I turned and looked. And I realized, you know, these weren't kids, these were men. And he was a man, and this was music that he cared about. And all of a sudden, I started thinking about music very differently than the stuff that I would buy in the record store or get off the radio. I thought, you learn songs from people. You learn these songs from people. So Fred was an immense inspiration to me in that regard. Or even Pete Seeger came around once in a while. he was famous. You couldn't get close to him very easily. After the concert, Fred was hanging out at the bar, and I bought his album, and he signed it for me. And you know, and later I got to play at his club a little bit, and I was really touched. Getting towards the end of his life, he came to see me one night. You know, he sang on everything, and you don't forget stuff like that.
Yeah, those guys ran a nice room.
They knew what they're doing, yeah, you know, yeah. And for a generation of people who, you know, I was a little behind all of the hubbub of Lincoln Avenue and the Earl of all that, but, you know, there was enough going on, and you could find your way, and you could get access to a lot of music, and along, of course, with the Old Town School.
I got all these questions, but you're making me think about. I talked to Richard Harding's daughter this week, and we were talking about stuff. And then I started thinking about the clubs back then. I came in the very tail end of that, but the clubs had faces. I mean, the clubs had people. I mean, the clubs had you had Ed and Fred Holstein, yeah. You had Richard Harding, you had Earl Pianchi. Yeah. You know, I just don't know if that exists or if I'm just out of touch.
I think the clubs.
Yeah.
Or, yeah, I don't know that that's
folk clubs
the same.
Or whatever. Yeah.
Certainly not with folk clubs as much. No, yeah. I can tell you
these guys were
who
characters. They were rock on tours.
But what you're saying kind of reminds me of like the way the school is, and this has been like a running theme that Mark and I talked about at the event last week, and with people who've been around the school for a long time, and Rebecca Armstrong, who was the daughter of George and Jerry Armstrong, who's a huge part of the school's beginnings. She in particular said that she remembers just these people, these faces that she wouldn't necessarily remember their names, but they defined the place. They made the place what it was by their constant presence there because they loved it. They were there to like stuff envelopes. They were there to sell tickets. And that's the same today, like with volunteers, like who do that for decades at a time. I mean, just as much as like a lot of us like started as volunteers, like I was a student, then I was a volunteer, and then I started working there. Wow. You know, we volunteer, a lot of us like start by volunteering our time, and that's why it is the way that it is.
When did you become a student there?
I first took a class that I recall from Jimmy T when I was 12, my first guitar class. My mom said I was a wiggle worm, but I don't remember that.
And how long ago was that?
That would have been like 2000. Okay. Yeah. Yeah, 2000.
Because kind of what I'm asking that is, and this is another one of my questions, when you did the Fred song, Mark, you know, okay, that's folk music.
Yeah.
And I'm thinking about how do people, and we've talked about this in the show in terms of world music and ethnic music, but how do people look at folk music today? And I'm going to throw out Bob Dylan. I went to see Bob Dylan. He's doing Frank Sinatra.
So yeah.
Is Beck, I mean, maybe I'd call Beck a folk musician. I mean, how do you guys, how do you all define folk music today?
And by the way, the first words to the song are, "When I look at my brown suitcase." So,
yeah. Okay.
But how do you define folk music? You know, I think, I love the term. I think it's a one-size-fits-all, you know? What do you think, Colby? Put your feet up.
Sorry. Well, I think folk music is something that people can discover for themselves if allowed to. I think that it's not always easy to do that, given the way commercial music works, because commercial music tries to hide the origins of things and present everything as this new, shined-up thing. Even when people write their own songs, you know, they're getting that influence from somewhere.
That's right.
And so Old Town has always tried to present an idea that, well, it all comes from somewhere, and here's a bunch of songs in our songbook that represent different song types and that are not necessarily – we're not going to be saying that these are the golden arrangements that were the first arrangements, but they're definitely – they are very true to the core of each one of these types of origins.
Mm-hmm.
And I won't even say styles because it's just different from different parts of our, mostly from our American experience, although we do, Old Town's good about throwing in a couple of tunes like we put La Bamba in recently. And but basically folk music is something that you have to let people discover for themselves.
Yeah, that's so true. I feel like folk music kind of hides in its own little many different corners, and it doesn't advertise itself.
No.
You know, it exists in the spaces where people come together to make it, and there's so many different like versions of it. So I think that's why it's so exciting and important, like for me to be able to like share a lot of this music and these stories that I think are so neat because they're all different. They're all just like their own little niche.
Stories.
You know?
Yeah. Marieva was doing a podcast series recently where she was grabbing a song and telling a story about it, a song from our songbook. And it was beautiful. You can still catch it. It's of course, a podcast, so it's available on iTunes. But my favorite...
The Archives Podcast.
The Archives Podcast. My favorite was John Henry. And you'd think, man, I've heard everything I can possibly hear about John Henry. I don't know. I guess I'll listen to this if I have to. So I put it on, and I'm just... My mind is blown. She's got a great piece on that. You should just check that out. Just because even though it's maybe old and you may have heard about it sort of, or there's always room to get more from a lot of these core material songs that we try to represent.
Yeah. Because, and it's like up to us to share that with people if we want it to remain.
Absolutely.
Yeah. You were talking about spaces. People find it in certain spaces. Yeah. I mean, here they were going someplace. Obviously, you know where I'm going with this. Now there's social media. There's all kinds of places out there. So talk about how the school responds to that, specifically what you're doing with the podcast.
Is one way, but also, see, Dave, you're holding in your hands and looking at, right now, you're looking at that biography of a hunch, was a history that was written,
10-year anniversary.
10-year, long, long time ago.
Yeah.
Okay, and it was written by a wonderful woman who did a really great job and wrote everything that Jim Hirsch, the director at the time, wanted her to write. So it's a very slanted history of the school, and it's not inaccurate, but it's definitely embellished. So what we put in place was we spent years actually working on this. I worked with this with a PhD, ethnomusicology PhD. Who was actually a volunteer for me for many years, named Tanya Lee, and she wrote the script for a tour of the Old Town School history, and it's in an app. It's embedded in an app. So you asked about how we're responding now. Mm-hmm. We're trying things like podcasts. This is an app that's available by this company named Vamon.
Yeah, they've been on the show.
They're great.
We did a thing for them actually on Tiki Bars.
Oh, sure.
They're
incredible. Yeah. I mean, and so they basically were my receptacle for Tanya's work, all of six chapters of her work. It's a 6-chapter book that we embedded into this app, and it accompanies an in-building exhibit of the school's history in pictures. That's like basically 6 chapters out of the book. So you can come and look at it in the building, which you're invited to do. Everyone's invited to come to the building and look, but also you can download this app for free.
On your phone,
and you get more information. You get more pictures. You get video. There's a lot of video, audio, archival audio. So it's everything that we've spent years putting together in the archive and preserving, just pushed right to your phone.
Yeah, I feel like our job and what Colby and I see as our job is to just make it as accessible as possible to people in a lot of different ways.
Yep.
Yeah.
Okay, we got to take a break, and then I want to come back and talk about the podcast, how people can find those, and then I want to get back on protest music. Nocturnal Journal on WGN.
Once I had an old banjo, it was strung with twine. The only tune that I could play was Trouble on My Mind. Trouble on my mind, trouble on my mind, trouble on my mind. Oh, raining, snowing, hailing from the sky. If I don't get my true love, I reckon I will die. 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 Trouble on my mind, boy.
Gonna get a picture of you there with the microphone. Mark Dvorak and Trouble on My Mind. Yeah. Tell us about that song.
It's commonly known as Trouble on My Mind, and Fleming Brown, the great banjo teacher, learned that from a guy who lived in eastern Kentucky, Rufus Crisp, and that's Rufus's take on an old song that comes from who knows where. I've always imagined it was made up by a black man who got tired of hearing a guy in grease paint sing "Oh Susanna," so he made up his own song. Kind of a protest song in
a
way.
It's a protest song.
Protest, that's what I'm all about here. Get that going. I'm going to go right around the room. Colby Maddox, tell us about the new songbook.
Yes, we have a new songbook at the Old Town School. I spent a year and a half working with five teachers and putting together the charts, so they're much, much more improved. We did not actually completely change the repertoire, but we added a lot of really cool new songs.
Such as?
Tenting Tonight, which is an old Civil War song. That can be done rock and roll style or old Civil War style or choral style. But these are tunes that are all adaptable and can be done in many different ways. Their African-American origins are very, very common with this, is what we found out. We started writing attributions for each song, and I got some help from Greg Wilson, who was a founder of the Carolina Chocolate Drops and the Black Banjo Movement. He all email and all phone calls with him for like about a month, and he helped me put the glossary and the attributions together. And one of his favorite songs is "Trouble on My Mind." He was a great help. And we found what I found out, and we both kind of discovered that this huge section of this music is about protesting. It's about calling your case out to the entire world and putting it in such a clever, singable, playable way. That it can be repeated generation after generation, and the meaning is not, again, out there necessarily in plain view, but it's pretty clear when you really get into the song.
Uh-huh.
So that's the level of protest music that each one of these songs really speaks for itself.
60th anniversary edition, is it out now?
It's out. You can buy it.
Okay. Yeah. Okay. And tell me about the podcast.
Well, kind of concurrent, like with Colby working really hard on this songbook, I've been working with StoryCorps for the past about a year. They approached us a year ago wanting to do a partnership, which was very exciting. And it gave me kind of an unparalleled opportunity to just like get people, not just to kind of talk to people, but people would be excited to talk to us, to be archived like in the Library of Congress, as well as to be part of this like year-long oral history. And we collected over 50 conversations between people from like across the school's 60 years.
Give me some names.
Yeah. So we talked to Ted Johnson, and his wife, Marsha Johnson. Ted Johnson was there before the school began in the living room of Don Greening, and he was the second teacher of the Old Town School. He's now a student today of fiddle at the school. Ella Jenkins was there again at the first night. We talked to her, which was really fun. She was just a great like person to meet personally. We talked to Mark. We talked to Colby.
You've been there since 99?
Yeah.
99, yeah. 99.
Yeah.
We talked to Rebecca Armstrong, who's one of the two daughters in the Armstrong family, which was a founding family at the Old Town School.
And yes.
We found out all kinds of stuff.
Yeah, she's amazing. Her entire interview is great. Like, I mean, there's just some great storytellers. And then Eddie Holstein, of course.
Eddie's
and there are people, like, I had talked
do
to...
Do you fact check Eddie?
One thing I'd like to say... yeah. I'd like to say, I don't... propose like or say that I am doing a complete history of the Old Town School by any means, nor do I think that's necessarily possible, but I am putting together and releasing over the past and future several Thursdays a documentary series including a ton of the stuff we've collected along with stuff from the archives, like music and interviews from the archives.
That's
that
fascinating.
Well.
We should link up to this when we do the podcast. Yeah. How can people find the,
It's called the Archives Podcast. It's really easy to find. Also, if you just search Old Town School Folk Music on iTunes or SoundCloud for free, you can just download all the 12 podcasts we did before, as well as the three that have so far come out in this series. If you subscribe, then you'll just get them right away. Otherwise, you can also follow us on Facebook under the Archives Podcast.
What have you learned about the school and music that you didn't know before you got into this project?
Oh boy, so much. I really feel like I knew this before, but in a certain way, but what has been a constant reminder is just how important this place is to each and every one of these people. And like, it's just important in all these like little ways that like don't seem like big things, but they matter so much to everyone who comes there every day. And it matters a lot to me. Like, it's just a place that has mattered a lot for people to be able to come to as like, I think Ba likes to say, like a third place in their life.
Third
you know?
Place. We've got about 3 minutes. And I don't know if we can answer this question in 3 minutes. And maybe, Mark, maybe you've said this and maybe I've heard it, but it's a school that helps people teach themselves how to carry things over into daily life and stuff.
Mm-hmm.
Talk about that method in 3 minutes.
Very, very quickly. What we found, some really great archival audio that's right on the app, is that when Strachey, the founder, was looking specifically to find a place where amateurs and professional musicians could work together, because he was saying each has a valid viewpoint on music and can help and like to be in the same place and like to inform each other, but there's often never the circumstance for that. And so he was, I think the concept was is that the teachers and the students would be enlightened by the experience of being together.
Well said, yeah.
Yeah. You want to add to that, Maria?
I was really also, I enjoyed talking to Jane Strachey, I should mention, about her father. She was just so generous, and thinking back on the conversation we had about the blacklisting, she talked really frankly about how that affected her father and her family, and that shaped the way that all of their lives were, and he was very depressed. He had bipolar.
Right.
And this really was part of the reason why I think they had to create a space like the Old Town School. Like, so it really, it definitely like gave me a great understanding of like the forces that had come together that made it such that the school had to exist for all these people.
One of the things that, we've all witnessed is that we're brought up purchasing music, download CDs, tickets to concerts. But when you become a participant and you begin learning to become the author of your own creative life, that's when life changes utterly. And that's one of the things the school has been the sponsor of.
Maria Valindo, Colby Maddox, Mark Dvorak. Thank you all for coming down. This flew by.
Thank you, Dave.
A lot of questions.
Thank you. Wonderful.
We'll catch up at the Cordial Inn, Mark.
There you go.
What town is that in? Brookfield?
That's in Brookfield.
Next to a gas station.
Next to a gas
Thanks for listening to Nocturnal Journal. We'll be back next week on WGN.